Magic. Do not speak to me of magic. It is just like everything else, full of setbacks and disappointments. So states one of the characters in the recent best-selling fantasy novel, Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell. In this fascinating novel, history real and imagined is interwoven with some extremely entertaining characters. My name is Maeve Riley, and this is the Afternoon Magazine. Today, our guest is Susanna Clark, author of the recent novel, Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell. You can join our conversation by calling 333-9455, that's 333-WILL, or toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Susanna Clark, thanks for joining us.
You're very welcome. It's nice to be talking to you.
Oh, great. And I just want to make sure I get the pronunciation right. Is it Norrell or Norrell?
Norrell is how I say it, although I'm really not that fussy.
Okay, great. And I wondered if you could set the scene up for some of those listeners who may not have had the pleasure yet of reading your novel. It's a book about magic in early 19th century Britain and features some wonderful characters. And what's important to the story is not only what's happening in the novel, but the history of magic prior to its opening. And could you tell our listeners a little bit about the history that you've created?
Yeah, it's set in a version of England where, during the medieval period, England was divided into two kingdoms. And there was a northern kingdom and a southern kingdom. And the northern kingdom was ruled by a magician king who's most commonly known as the Raven King, although he has other names and titles. And he was someone who had been stolen away to Faerie as a child and who had returned as a very young man or a boy even at the head of a Faerie army and who had taken possession of the northern part of England. And he ruled it for 300 years. And during that time, he trained other magicians and there was a thriving community of fairies and there was a golden age of magic in England. But during the 15th century, for some reason, he decided to leave and the fairies followed him. And since that time, magic has fallen into decay until the advent of Mr. Norrell in the early 1800s.
And the title of the novel is Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell. And I'd like you, if you wouldn't mind, to read the description of their initial meeting. I think it's on page 224.
Absolutely. Sure. Yes. At this point, Mr. Norrell has established himself in London. He's actually from Yorkshire, but he's established himself. And he's proved his claim to do practical magic. And he has been helping the government in the war against France. But Mr. Norrell is a very jealous little man, and he can't bear the thought of other magicians. So Mr. Drawlight turned slightly in his chair, smiled, and said, "It seems, sir, that you have a rival." Before Mr. Norrell could think of a suitable reply, Lascelles asked what was the man's name. "Strange," said Drawlight. "I do not know him," said Lascelles. "Oh," cried Drawlight, "I think you must. Jonathan Strange of Shropshire. £2,000 a year." "I have not the least idea whom you mean. Oh, but wait, is not this the man who, when an undergraduate at Cambridge, frightened a cat belonging to the master of Corpus Christi?" Drawlight agreed that this was the very man. Lascelles knew him instantly, and they both laughed. Meanwhile, Mr. Norrell sat silent as a stone. Drawlight's opening remark had been a terrible blow. He felt as if Drawlight had turned and struck him, as if a figure in a painting or a table or a chair had turned and struck him. The shock of it had almost taken his breath away. He was quite certain he would be ill. What Drawlight might say next, Mr. Norrell dared not think. Something of greater powers, perhaps, of wonders performed, besides which Mr. Norrell's own would appear pitiful indeed. And he had taken such pains to ensure there could be no rivals. He felt like a man who goes about his house at night, locking doors and barring windows, only to hear the certain sounds of someone walking about in an upstairs room. But as the conversation progressed, these unpleasant sensations lessened, and Mr. Norrell began to feel more comfortable. As Drawlight and Lascelles talked of Mr. Strange's Brighton pleasure trips and visits to Bath, and Mr. Strange's estate in Shropshire, Mr. Norrell thought he understood the sort of man this Strange must be. a fashionable, shallow sort of man, a man not unlike Lascelles himself. That being so, said Mr. Norrell to himself, was it not more probable that "You have a rival" was addressed not to himself but to Lascelles? This strange, thought Mr. Norrell, must be Lascelles' rival in some love affair or other. Norrell looked down at his hands clasped in his lap and smiled at his own folly. And so, said Lascelles, Strange is now a magician. Oh, said Drawlight, turning to Mr. Norrell, I am sure that not even his greatest friends would compare his talents to those of the estimable Mr. Norrell, but I believe he is well enough thought of in Bristol and Bath. He is in London at present. His friends hope that you will be kind enough to grant him an interview, and may I express a wish to be present when two such practitioners of the art meet? Mr. Norrell lifted his eyes very slowly. I shall be happy to meet Mr. Strange, he said. Mr. Drawlight was not made to wait long before he witnessed the momentous interview between the two magicians, which was just as well, for Mr. Drawlight hated to wait. An invitation was issued, and both Lascelles and Drawlight made it their business to be present when Mr. Strange waited upon Mr. Norrell. He proved neither as young nor as handsome as Mr. Norrell had feared. He was nearer 30 than 20, and as far as another gentleman may be permitted to judge these things, not handsome at all. But what was very unexpected was that he brought with him a pretty young woman, Mrs. Strange. Mr. Norrell began by asking Strange if he had brought his writing. He would, he said, very much like to read what Mr. Strange had written. My writing? Said Strange, and paused a moment. I am afraid, sir, that I am at a loss to know what you mean. I have written nothing. Oh, said Mr. Norrell, Mr. Drawlight told me that you had been asked to write something for the Gentleman's Magazine, but perhaps... Oh, that, said Strange, I have scarcely thought about it. Nichols assured me that he did not need it until the Friday after next. A week on Friday and not yet begun, said Mr. Norrell, very much astonished. Oh, said Strange, I think that the quicker one gets these things out of one's brain and onto the paper and off to the printers, the better. I dare say, sir, and he smiled at Mr. Norrell in a friendly manner, that you find the same. Mr. Norrell, who had never yet got anything successfully out of his brain and off to the printers, whose every attempt was still at some stage or other of revision, said nothing. As to what I shall write, continued Strange, I do not quite know yet. But it will most likely be a refutation of Portishead's article in The Modern Magician. Did you see it, sir? It put me in a rage for a week. He sought to prove that modern magicians have no business dealing with fairies. It is one thing to admit that we have lost the power to raise such spirits. It is quite another to renounce all intention of ever employing them. I have no patience with any such squeamishness. But what is most extraordinary is that I have yet to see any criticism of Portishead's article anywhere. Now that we have something approaching a magical community, I think we would be very wrong to let such thick-headed nonsense pass unreproved. Strange, apparently thinking that he had talked enough, waited for one of the other gentlemen to reply. After a moment or two of silence, Mr. Lascelles remarked that Lord Portishead had written the article at Mr. Norrell's express wish and with Mr. Norrell's aid and approval. Indeed, Strange looked very much astonished. There was a silence of some moments, and then Lascelles languidly inquired how one learnt magic these days. From books, said Strange. Ah, sir, cried Mr. Norrell, how glad I am to hear you say so. Waste no time, I implore you, in pursuing any other course, but apply yourself constantly to reading. No sacrifice of time or pleasure can ever be too great. Strange regarded Mr. Norrell somewhat ironically and then remarked, Unfortunately, lack of books has always been a great obstacle. I dare say you have no conception, sir, how few books of magic there are left in circulation in England. All the booksellers agree that a few years ago there were a great many, but now? Indeed, interrupted Mr. Norrell hurriedly. Well, that is very odd, to be sure. The silence which followed was peculiarly awkward. Here sat the only two English magicians of the modern age. One confessed that he had no books. The other, as was well known, had two great libraries stuffed with them. Mere common politeness seemed to dictate that Mr. Norrell make some offer of help, however slight. But Mr. Norrell said nothing.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, Mr. Norrell is afraid of other magicians and a bit jealous of someone coming up and rivaling him. And could you talk a little bit about his libraries and how he doesn't share them? Yes.
Yeah, at the beginning of the book, the very, very beginning, two theoretical magicians who are magicians who love to study the theory and the history of magic, but who can't do any practical magic, indeed have never really attempted it, discover Mr. Norrell, and they are shown his library at a little distance from the city of York, and it's full of the most wonderful collection of magical books from all eras of England's magical past. And it is the most astonishingly large library they have ever seen. And later, Norrell goes down to London, he takes some of the books, but the choice items he leaves in Yorkshire, and where they are fairly inaccessible to everyone else. And it is a constant problem for Norrell that he loves English magic and he wants to restore it, but he can never really bear to tell anyone about it because he's such a quiet, desiccated, jealous little man. He has a problem. He doesn't really understand people, and he's more afraid of people than anything else. He finds it very difficult to tell the difference between a good person and a bad person.
That's good. And on the other hand, we have Jonathan Strange, a young, talented magician. Not an upstart exactly, but he's confident and he's willing to learn. And how would you compare him to Norrell and describe him?
He's, in many ways, the complete opposite. He's outgoing. He loves people. He's very charming. People are always very attracted to him. He's quite witty. And his attitude to magic is anything that he knows he will gladly share with anyone. And so, again, he's the exact opposite. He believes that more magicians should be trained, that knowledge should be shared. But they do have some similarities. They're both quite arrogant in their way. They're both quite egotistical.
And they have an interesting relationship. It progresses through many different stages.
Yes, yes. I mean, that was for me the seed of the novel, the thing that from which most things grew. This idea of two magicians who considered themselves absolute opposites, who thought they had nothing in common, but who, in the public eye at any rate, were always linked, and people always mentioned them in the same breath, and that made them more frustrated than ever.
And I know you've noted the passage that I quoted at the beginning as being key to the novel.
Yes, absolutely.
Right.
In some ways, this is an idea which I found in Ursula Le Guin's Earthsea trilogy, where she, the magic in those books is full of difficulties, and the difficulties, some of which are very great and some of which are just sort of small things, make magic seem like any other branch of learning. And it makes it seem, to me, it makes it seem very real. It fits into the world perfectly because magic brings its own problems. Sometimes the problems that it seems to bring with it are more than the things it solves. It's hard to learn and it has unforeseen consequences. So, you know, pretty much like anything else, like technology.
Mm-hmm. And living as you do in Cambridge, I wondered if academics had anyway been served as some kind of model for the magicians and, you know, the infighting. You talk about theoretical
Actually,
and practical. And
I don't know, really. I think it's drawn from the kind of the scholarly aspect of the book is drawn from many things. Somebody asked me if I had actually based Mr. Norrell possibly on my father. Which was a very interesting idea. My father is also somebody who, like Mr. Norrell, who negotiates the world through books and is actually more comfortable with books than anything else. But unlike Mr. Norrell, my father is actually a very kind and generous person. So I think there may have been something in that, and I was brought up in a house full of books. I think our scholars that I'd known at my time at university and now may have served as models, and also the stories of Jorge Luis Borges, who writes a lot about libraries and about scholars as well. I think something of that got into it too.
I'd like to take just a quick break here and reintroduce you. This is The Afternoon Magazine, and we're talking with novelist Susanna Clark, author of the recent novel Jonathan Strange and Mr. Gnarl. You can join our conversation by calling 333-9455. That's 333-WILL, or toll-free 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. And at the beginning, you talked a little bit about The Raven King, or John Usglass, and I wondered if you could talk a little bit more about how his absence in the novel affects the characters.
As I said, he was the king who ruled for over 300 years in northern England, and he was in many ways the creator of this discipline of magic which Gnarl and Strange practice. And after he leaves, and no one in the novel really knows why he goes after 300 years. He's still, to humanize at any rate, a young man. But at some point he decides to go, and he leaves England, and his court of fairies goes with him. And then gradually the fairies who live in other parts of England, they disappear as well. They appear to, or at least they seem to, no one knows where they are anymore, or if they've all gone back to fairy. And magic just starts to die out. And it lingers a little while, but gradually men and women cease to be able to do practical magic. And some of them still study it and write histories of it, but it isn't done anymore. And the Raven King, John Usglass himself, is regarded, people aren't really sure whether or not he was a totally good thing or not, and there's different ideas among scholars on this. He was reputed to rule a kingdom in faery as well as his English kingdom, and also a kingdom on the far side of hell, to which he paid tribute to Lucifer. So again, that sort of makes people a bit wary of him.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned that he's from the north of England, and I know that you are also from the north of England. And it almost becomes a character in your novel, the whole like concept of the north.
Yes. I mean, it was when I was a child, my father was a minister. We moved around a lot, but we lived a lot in the north and in the North Midlands. And I feel very attached to the landscape and the idea of Northern England. I feel more at home. My adult life actually has been spent almost all in the South, because that's where jobs were. But I have this sort of yearning, to go back. And one of the things I wanted to do was to explore my feelings about Northern England in this book, and to try and convey some of the magic that I feel is inherent in northern landscapes.
Mm-hmm. And can you explain to some of us landlocked Midwesterners here in the U.S. what is the difference between the north?
I think the archetypal northern English landscape is, if you think of the books of the Brontes, moors, empty places, rocks, much wilder places than the south. The southern English landscapes can be beautiful, but they tend to be more pastoral, more garden-like, possibly softer, whereas there's more lonely places in the north and more high moors strewn with rocks and more dramatic landscapes, more narrow valleys, ruined abbeys. The landscape is just that much more dramatic.
And magical.
Absolutely.
And I wonder if you wouldn't mind reading just another passage. It's the strange musician magician, who's not accepted by the others, but who offers a prophecy that drives the entire novel in a way.
Absolutely.
And that's Vinculus.
Excuse me. Yes, at this period in the book, Mr. Gnarl he's established in London as the government's magician. And there is in London, there are a number of street magicians who are probably quacks, mostly quacks. But the most important of these is Vinculus, who's a famous street magician. He has a booth in the street, and he tells he tells fortunes, and some of the stuff that he does is clearly fake. But he appears one day very suddenly in Mr. Norrell's house in London, and Mr. Norrell is quite alarmed. Vinculus leaned suddenly forward and bent over Mr. Norrell with a look of the most intense, burning concentration. Without quite meaning to, Mr. Norrell fell silent, and he leaned towards Vinculus to hear whatever Vinculus was about to confide to him. "I reached out my hand," whispered Vinculus. "England's rivers turned and flowed the other way." "I beg your pardon." "I reached out my hand," said Vinculus a little louder. "My enemy's blood stopped in their veins." He straightened himself, opened wide his arms, and closed his eyes as if in a religious ecstasy of some sort. In a strong, clear voice, full of passion, he continued, "I reached out my hand. Thought and memory flew out of my enemy's heads like a flock of starlings. My enemies crumpled like empty sacks. I came to them out of mists and rain. I came to them in dreams at midnight. I came to them in a flock of ravens that filled a northern sky at dawn. When they thought themselves safe, I came to them in a cry that broke the silence of a winter wood." "Yes, yes," interrupted Mr. Norrell. "Do you really suppose that this sort of nonsense is new to me? Every madman on every street corner screams out the same threadbare gibberish, and every vagabond with a yellow curtain tries to make himself mysterious by reciting something of the sort. It is in every third-rate book on magic published in the last 200 years. I came to them in a flock of ravens. What does that mean, I should like to know? Who came to who in a flock of ravens? Lucas?" Vinculus ignored him. His strong voice overpowered Mr. Norrell's weak, shrill one. "The rain made a door for me, and I went through it. The stones made a throne for me, and I sat upon it. Three kingdoms were given to me to be mine forever. England was given to me to be mine forever. The nameless slave wore a silver crown. The nameless slave was a king in a strange country." "Three kingdoms!" exclaimed Mr. Norrell. "Ha! Now I understand what this nonsense pretends to be, a prophecy of the Raven King. Well, I am sorry to tell you that if you hope to impress me by recounting tales of that gentleman, you will be disappointed. Oh, yes, you are entirely mistaken. There is no magician whom I detest more. The weapons that my enemies raised against me are venerated in hell as holy relics. Plans that my enemies made against me are preserved as holy texts. Blood that I shed upon ancient battlefields is scraped from the stained earth by hell's sacristans and placed in a vessel of silver and ivory. I gave magic to England, a valuable inheritance, but Englishmen have despised my gift. Magic shall be written upon the sky by the rain, but they shall not be able to read it. Magic shall be written on the faces of the stony hills, but their minds shall not be able to contain it. In winter, the barren trees shall be a black writing, but they shall not understand it. It is every Englishman's birthright to be served by competent and well-educated magicians," interrupted Mr. Norrell. "What do you offer them instead? Mystical ramblings about stones and rain and trees? This is like God bless, who told us we should learn magic from wild beasts in the forest. Why not pigs in the sty? Or stray dogs, I wonder. This is not the sort of magic which civilized men wish to see practiced in England nowadays." He gazed furiously at Vinculus, and as he did so, something caught his eye. Vinculus addressed himself with no particular care. His dirty neckcloth had been negligently wound about his neck, and a little gap of unclean skin showed between neckcloth and shirt. In that space was a curious curving mark of a vivid blue, not unlike the upward stroke of a pen. It might have been a scar, the relic of a street brawl, perhaps, but what it most resembled was that barbaric painting of the skin which is practiced by the natives of the South Sea Islands. Curiously, Vinculus, who was able to stand entirely at his ease in another man's house railing at him, seemed embarrassed by this mark. And when he saw that Mr. Norrell had observed it, he put his hand to his throat. throat and plucked at the cloth to hide it. Two magicians shall appear in England. A sort of exclamation broke from Mr. Norrell, an exclamation that began as a cry and ended as a soft, unhappy sigh. The first shall fear me, the second shall long to behold me. The first shall be governed by thieves and murderers, the second shall conspire at his own destruction. The first shall bury his heart in a dark wood beneath the snow, yet still feel its ache. The second shall see his dearest possession in his enemy's hand. Oh, now I know that you have come here with no other aim but to wound me. False magician, you are jealous of my success. You cannot destroy my magic, and so you are determined to blacken my name and destroy my peace. The first shall pass his life alone. He shall be his own jailer. The second shall tread lonely roads, the storm above his head, seeking a dark tower upon a high hillside.
Very good prophecy there from Vinculus that pretty much drives the novel. And we get a pretty good picture of Mr. Norrell there, too, from his response to Vinculus as well. I hate to bring it up, but your book has been compared to that of She Who Must Not Be Named, the author of the Harry Potter books. But your books are both popular, and they're both about magic, yet they're very different. And how do you feel about that comparison?
I am entirely unsurprised by it, and I can't say it bothers me at all. I think any book which is written now about magicians is bound to be compared to the great books about magicians of our time. I mean, and the ones which are so fantastically popular and which have done so much to encourage a whole generation of children to read. I think it's inevitable that the comparison should take place. I think I'm actually not the best person to sort of say how accurate the description is. I've only just started the Harry Potter novels. I'm only a few pages in, I think about 40.
And are you enjoying those?
I think the sense of a story just opening up around you, mm-hmm. It's a huge story. You get it from almost like the first page. It's amazing. I think a huge assured beginning. So I'm expecting to enjoy them. But I think readers will make up their own mm-hmm. mind.
And do you think there's anything in particular about magic as a driving a novel or that entices people? Or is, you know, why are not two novels or a few novels about magic really popular right now?
I think there's two things. One, I think there's some great fantasy writers around at the moment. The other is that I think people like to read about problems, but it's everyday problems, but on a larger scale. Mm. My novel. Excuse me. I'm sorry. I'm losing my voice at this point. Sorry. It's the end of a 3-week
yeah.
tour. So. Yeah, the problems in Strange and Norrell are the problems that everyone faces, but they're on a huge scale,
mm-hmm.
which I think is interesting. You can sort of deal with day-to-day problems, but at a very large remove. And I think that's one of the attractions of fantasy.
And, you know, it's fascinating that you chose to create this history of magic in Britain and base it on actual historical events. And I know that you've said in other interviews you really enjoyed researching the Napoleonic Wars. Why did you choose to set the novel on this period of history?
First of all, because of the novels of Jane Austen.
Mm.
She's been a favorite of mine since I was a child. I've read her novels more times than I can count. I felt very at home in the world she creates. And I also felt that if I set my novel at the same time as hers, I could draw upon her very precise descriptions of that society. And also then I discovered I had this really neat thing called the Napoleonic War, which was great for my magicians to show what they could do.
And I loved how you brought in, you know, the real-life politicians and the monarchs of the day, King George, and of course having the mad King George adds a little to any story, I think. But your research must have been quite extensive. You know, Byron's in there, Richard Brinsley Sheridan, and of course a lot of politicians, Pitt, Wellington. How did you conduct your research?
I did it in conjunction with the writing.
Mm-hmm.
And I did two sorts of research. One was that I researched the things I really needed to know, and I also researched things that were just interesting to me, and I didn't know if they would really connect up with the novel, but I hoped that they would, and sometimes they really, it really fed the novel just by doing researching domestic items, folklore, all these sorts of things. It was really interesting.
And, of course, your footnotes are quite extensive. And do you think this novel would be one of those reference books that might be found in a future Mr. Norrell's library?
That's interesting. I think it might be, but I think they would say some very scathing things about it. I think the scholars, like Mr. Norrell, would really pull it apart.
Right.
She's got all this wrong.
Well, I kept wondering who the researcher was and who wrote these footnotes, because the narrator is obviously a very opinionated person who knows quite a lot about magic.
I think that the narrator is probably me, but mm-hmm. in the 1820s. And I kind of think the narrator wrote the footnotes as well. She seems quite an educated person. Yeah, I think probably it's the same person, although it could possibly, somebody has suggested it might be Mr. Segundus, and that was a very interesting idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that did cross my mind for a while. And I have to admit that I don't know a lot about fantasy fiction, but I know that you admire Austen, who you already mentioned, and Charles Dickens. And I found your novel to follow those genres a lot. And the characters are so great, Chiler Mass, the Poles, Stephen. And are there any that you particularly identify with more than other?
The characters.
Okay. Yes, of the characters.
Yeah. I think Childermas, because mm-hmm. he was the person who surprised me most. I intended him at the very beginning to be a villain, and he went off in his own direction entirely. And I think for an author, that's really great to have a character who surprises you.
You know, I'm going to give you a chance to get a glass of water real quick.
Thank
if you want.
Very much.
And I'm going to read one of my favorite parts, because I quite identified with Stephen Black. I really found him an interesting character. So I won't read this as well as you do, but I'm going to go ahead and read a description of a dream that Stephen had.
Brilliant.
Okay, and you can get a drink of water.
Thank you very much.
Okay. The icy wind blew upon Stephen. The damp seeped up into every part of his being. The blackness pressed down upon him, and the long hours passed with excruciating slowness. He had no expectation of being able to sleep, but at some time during the night he experienced a little relief from the misery of his situation. It was not that he fell asleep exactly, but he did fall to dreaming. In his dream, he had gone to the pantry to fetch someone a slice of magnificent pork pie, but when he cut the pie open, he found that there was a very little pork inside it. Most of the interior was taken up by the city of Birmingham. Within the pie crust, forges and smithies smoked and engines pounded. One of the citizens, a civil-looking person, happened to stroll out from the cut that Stephen had made, and when his glance fell upon Stephen, he said, "Just then a high, mournful sound broke in upon Stephen's dream, a slow, sad song in an unknown language, and Stephen understood without ever actually waking that the gentleman with the thistle-down hair was singing. It may be laid down as a general rule that if a man begins to sing, no one will take any notice of his song except his fellow human beings. This is true even if his song is surpassingly beautiful. Other men may be in raptures at his skill, but the rest of creation is, by and large, unmoved. Perhaps a cat or dog may look at him. His horse, if it is an exceptionally intelligent beast, may pause in cropping the grass, but that is the extent of it. But when the fairy sang, the whole world listened to him. Stephen felt clouds pause in their passing. He felt sleeping hills shift and murmur. He felt cold mists dance. He understood for the first time that the world is not dumb at all, but merely waiting for someone to speak to it in a language it understands. In the fairy's song, the earth recognized the names by which it called itself. Stephen began to dream again. This time he dreamt that hills walked and the sky wept. Trees came and spoke to him and told him their secrets, and also whether or not he might regard them as friends or enemies. Important destinies were hidden inside pebbles and crumpled leaves. He dreamt that everything in the world, stones and rivers, leaves and fire, had a purpose which it was determined to carry out with the utmost rigor. but he also understood that it was possible sometimes to persuade things to a different purpose. When he awoke, it was dawn, or something like dawn. The light was watery, dim, and incomparably sad. Vast, gray, gloomy hills rose up all around them, and in between the hills there was a wide expanse of black bog. Stephen had never seen a landscape so calculated to reduce the onlooker to utter despair in an instant. "This is one of your kingdoms, I suppose," he said. "My kingdoms?" exclaimed the gentleman in surprise. "Oh, no, this is Scotland. I hoped we would at least get a person from Scotland calling in and maybe say that Scotland would not reduce the onlooker to utter despair in an instant." But I thought, I loved how you, the dream state that Stephen was in, and how that, it was just a beautiful passage, I think.
You read it beautifully.
Oh, well, thank you. Not as well as you.
Well, actually, I don't know that I've ever heard anyone read a passage out loud from the book. That was really great.
And you offset the reality with fairies and the fairy world. And does that have relevance to anything today? And I wondered if you could describe how fairies figure in the story.
They're the source of magic. It's the Raven King, or John Askless, learnt his magic from them. And they're kind of strong on magic, but weak on reason.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas people are strong on reason and weak on magic. So my idea of them is that they're very alien. Mm-hmm. They don't have very strong ideas of right and wrong, but they are very powerful.
Mm-hmm. And the thistle man with the thistle down hair is one of the fairies that,
yes, he
hears a lot. Yes. I just wondered, what authors are you reading at present? You mentioned you're reading one of the Harry Potter books. Is there anybody else that you...
Harry Potter. I'm also reading a book about Elizabeth and Mary, Queen Elizabeth and Queen Mary, Queen of Scots, by Jane Dunn, which I think has just been published over here. I've just finished that, and that was really enjoyable.
Go ahead.
And I've been reading some William Nicholson, who is an American children's fantasy writer, and again, The Windsinger. Really enjoyed that. Very good trilogy.
So you do read a lot of fantasy yourself? And
I do, particularly some of the children's fantasy writers, and I also read comics as well. Alan Moore, who's a great... probably the greatest comics writer in the world today, an Englishman, and he writes about a lot about magic as well.
And I know Neil Gaiman, is that right?
Yeah.
Is a friend of yours and also an author, and I don't have fantasy writer as well.
Yes, and his last book, American Gods, created a mythology of America rather than Britain, which sort of places America at the center of the fantastic world, which is a really neat idea, I think.
And Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell is number 3 or 4 on the New York Times bestseller list.
And
it was on the long list for the Booker Prize and the Guardian First Book Award. And as an author, it's your first novel, although you have been working on it for 10 years or so, how do you feel about all this attention and hype that you're getting?
It's extraordinary. It's wonderful, but it's a little bit, you know, sometimes you have to think, right, I'm going to think about something else for a while or I'm going to get dizzy.
Mm-hmm.
But it is absolutely fantastic. I don't think there's much else you can say. It's kind of a bit difficult to take in. The book, I think, especially, was something I never, ever expected. I mean, I was thrilled to be on the long list.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think a few years ago they wouldn't have put a novel, however well written they might have thought it was, but a novel with magicians and fairies, I think, wouldn't have stood a chance on getting on the Booker list. So I think that's a kind of sign of the boundaries between genres beginning to break down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, you know, a fantasy novel, I was just going to say that, for getting so much attention and to be published by Bloomsbury, and I believe this is the first one that Bloomsbury's published.
Yes, although we originally approached Bloomsbury because we thought they wouldn't be afraid of magicians. They're the publisher of Harry Potter in the UK. So we kind of felt that they at least wouldn't be nervous about that. And indeed, it was amazing. They got the book so completely from immediately. It was wonderful. They really understood what it was. And that's a wonderful thing for a writer.
I'd like to go back to the novel for just a second and talk about the women in your novel. I found them fascinating characters. You know, I guess maybe they were largely ignored by their husbands, I think. But they had a lot of personality and drive. And there were even a few female magicians, much to the horror of people like Mr. Norrell.
Yes.
But I think for that time period, it was quite remarkable. And I wondered if, you know, you could comment a little bit on that.
My main concern, partly because I was drawing so much on Jane Austen, my main concern was that the women should be authentically of their time. So the two main female characters, Strange's wife and another lady of a slightly higher rank in society, that they shouldn't be. I hate it when there are characters in historical novels who have late 20th or early 21st century attitudes for no reason. You know, they're completely out of context. So I wanted to show, particularly with Strange's wife, a woman who was, on the whole, pretty satisfied with the role that society laid out for her. Because you can see from the novels of Jane Austen that women, by and large, didn't resent the role that they had in Regency society. They might have resented being poor or not getting chances in life, but they want the things that they aspired to were things that that society did offer them. And I think also in the Regency period, women did have a better deal than they had, say, later in the Victorian era, a bit later in the 19th century, when they were sometimes considered almost no better than children or weren't really considered able to take responsibility, that they had a bit more freedom in the Regency period and they could control their lives to a certain extent and have influence in their spheres.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, the relationships between the women, too, are interesting, particularly amongst Arabella Strange and Lady Poole and later with Flora Greysteel, who comes in later. And, you know, do you think those would have been typical?
I think you can see that in Jane Austen, who is by far the best reference, I think, that we have for the way people thought. And also, if you read biographies of Jane Austen and other women, the relationships with their sisters and their female cousins and their female friends were, I think, very strong in those days. They wrote endless letters to each other. Without telephone, email, television, and all these things, just sort of socializing with people were very strong. If you look at the relationship between Emma Woodhouse in Emma and her ex-governess, it's a very close relationship. People wanted to maintain those ties. So yes, I do think it's quite realistic.
And the way the men treated their spouses?
The men don't treat the women badly, but they don't have a lot of attention to give to them. But in some ways, this is more a matter of character, I think. Strange's character is always that he's a little bit tied up in his own world, and he's not good at focusing on things which aren't his interest. So I think that's not so much a matter of period. It's more a matter of character.
Mm-hmm. And I'd like to go back for a minute, too, to the Napoleonic Wars and how that figured in the novel and how, you know, the research that you must have done to find all that information.
Sure. It was something I was rather dreading doing because I really I'd never really touched on military history before, but I found that it was fascinating. It's a very vivid sort of history. A lot of it is based on eyewitness accounts, which means that not only do you get a real sense of the horror and suffering that people had to endure in as being part of a Regency army, but also you get a real sense of the very human relationships between the men you get a lot of humor as well, because people in extreme situations are very fond of a joke. And there was a lot of good humor and camaraderie in those armies. And so it's not all grim. Mm-hmm. I found it very, very enjoyable to read.
And also to kind of mess with the history a little bit in terms of the magic.
Yeah, I didn't want to make it so that Strange went into Wellington's employment and just sort of solved all the problems and won the war for them. Mm. Because I felt that was kind of, even though it was 200 years ago, that was kind of disrespectful to the men who actually fought in these horrific conditions. So Strange is there very much as part of an organization. He's a member of a team, just as the engineers were or other people, specialists that Wellington employed. He's there to help Wellington, and it was great fun sort of working out what sort of magic would be really useful.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily showy, and sometimes Wellington tells Strange off for just sort of doing showy magic,
mm-hmm.
when in actual fact he needs to do very practical magic that answers the concerns of that army.
Mm-hmm. That was quite enjoyable. Very interesting. And I know you mentioned you're very detail-oriented and, you know, things that you know, like a knife or something might take your fancy. And you can...
Yes. I have a tendency to, if I start writing about some small detail of the society, I'd kind of want to go and research that and buy books on it. And I'd have to sort of restrain myself and think, this is only going to, like this fruit knife is only going to appear in one paragraph in the entire book. I really mustn't go off and research fruit knives. It's a bit of a waste of time. But it's also fun, and sometimes it feeds back into the narrative, and I think it makes it more convincing and of its period.
Mm-hmm. And I don't want you to strain your voice any more than necessary, but I wondered if there was one particular passage that you enjoyed reading.
Sure.
Okay. Wait, I'm just getting the note that I have to cut this interview short, so I apologize for that. Sorry, it's been so enjoyable talking to you.
It's been great fun.
Yeah.
And I'm very sorry that my voice has been a bit quavery. I hope it hasn't made it too difficult to listen to.
Well, I understand. I think you've been quite all around the United States.
Yeah, we're into week four now,
but we're
pretty much at the end.
Okay. Well, Susanna Clark, thank you so much for joining us. For our listeners, you can find Jonathan Strange and Mr. Gnarl, published by Bloomsbury, at your local bookstore. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Thanks to Jason Croft, our board operator, and Harriet Williamson, the executive producer. I'm Maeve Riley. Joining us now is Todd Gleason. He has today's settlement prices from the Chicago Board of Trade.
Thanks very much, Maeve. From the Chicago Board of Trade and the Mercantile Exchange, settlements came across like this at the board for the feed grains this afternoon. Wheat futures were down 13 cents that after USDA's quarterly grain stocks report released this morning showed larger stocks of wheat across the board on hand, in particular a larger stock of spring wheat, which most had thought would be a little bit lower as the Canadians had some problems with their wheat crop in the far northern reaches of North America. But that was not the case. Down 13 cents in the nearby December contract. 314.5 was the high, the low at 305.75. They settled at 306.75, down 13. The beans and the corn following suit. Of course, harvest pressure continuing there as well. March futures in the wheat pit now. 326.5 high, low at 318. Their settlement price at 318.75, off 14 for the day. The May contract at 330 high, low at 324. Settled a half above that at 324.5, down 12.5 for the day. In July futures, 335 the high, low at 329. Settled 329.25, down 10.75. September corn, 9 cents lower. Rather, September wheat, 9 cents lower. Scared somebody out there today. 340 the high, the low at 336. Settlement price at 337 for that September next year wheat contract. It was down 9. Now the corn futures, they were off 1.75 in the December contract. 206.75 the high, low at 204. Settled 205.5 once again. That was down 1.75. March futures, 217.5 high, low at 215. The settlement price at 216.25, 1.75 lower. And the May contract at 224.5 high, low at 222.25. Settled 223.5, down 1.75. July futures, 230.75 the high, the low at 228.5. Settled 229.75, 1.5 lower. And the September, 237.75 high, low at 236. Settlement price at 236.5, down 1.25. December futures were unchanged at 245.5 for the settlement price, with a high of 245.5 and low at 243.75 for next year, December corn contract. December oats now, 146.75. The high, the low at 140.5, settled 144.25. They were down 2.5 cents for the day. The March futures are 151.5 high, low at 148, settled at 151.25, down 2.25. Nove beans, 532, the high, the low at 525, settled 527, down 6.5 cents. The January's a 540 high, low at 532, settled 534.75, down 6. And the March, 546 the high, the low at 539, settled 539.75, down 8.25. May contract a 553 high, low at 546.5, settled 547.75, down 6.75. And July soybeans, 558.5 the high, the low at 553, settled 555, down 6. November contract a 559 high, and a settlement price there on that high, down 0.5 cent, with a low at 555. October bean meal, 158.70 the high, the low at 156, settled 156.20. They were off 230. The Dease meal settled at 260 lower at 159.70. October bean oil at 20.78 high, low at 20.34, settled 20.52. They were off 29 cents, and the December contract at 20.74 on the settlement price at the end of this Thursday afternoon finished 8 cents lower. Now here's Tom Rogers with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange.
Thanks a lot, and we had a down day for cattle and up day for hogs as we finished Thursday on the Mercantile Exchange. September feeder cattle today had a high of 114.65, the low 114.55, settled at 114.62.5, down 17.5. The October contract had a high of 112.30, the low 111.40, settled at 111.77.5, down 40. November feeders, the high 110.12.5, the low price for the day 109.20, it settled at 109.50, down 62.5. On to live cattle for October. The high today was 85.72.5, the low 84.75, settled at 85.07.5, down 82.5. December live cattle, the high 87.90, the low 86.95, settled at 87.27.5, down 65. October lean hogs, the high today 75.15, the low 74.25, settled at 75 even, up 50. December, the high 69.65, the low 68.20, settled at 69.12.5, up 55. February lean hogs had a high of 67.95, a low of 66.55. That settlement was at 67.80, up 112.5. And April lean hogs had a high of 64.95, the low 64.10, settled at 64.77.5, up 17.5. February pork bellies, the high today 97.80, the low 95.30, settled at 97.37.5, up 65. Quick look at the stock markets right now. The Dow is down 59 points at 10,077. The NASDAQ, however, is up almost 5 points at 1,899. The S&P down a fraction at 1,115.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: Natural Gourmet, Champaign, Prairie Boat Works, Champaign, and Ray's Heating and Air Conditioning in Urbana. These business